Hello, listeners. This is Cody Starkin, and I would like to welcome you to another episode of Standing Post. This episode is an important one, as we get to interview a Secret Service investigative analyst, but I would also like to mention that this episode marks the one-year anniversary since the launch of the show. I hope you had a great year learning about the different aspects of the organization. We will continue to improve our show and bring you the best guests possible each month. I would like to thank you all for all the support of the show and hope you continue the journey for another great year. Now, for this month's show, we bring you an investigative analyst who currently works at our Paris field office. Considered an expert for the assigned office, he is responsible for conducting and coordinating complex research projects in support of special agent investigations of a wide variety. Other duties can sometimes fall into a support role with local law enforcement officers that need assistance in locating a criminal, which is a part of the topic of this month's show. So please welcome to Standing Post, investigative analyst Ryan Heathouse. Welcome to the show, Ryan. Thank you for joining us. As always, with any of my guests that come on the show, I'd like you to introduce yourself and tell the listeners who you are and what you do.
My name is Ryan Heathouse. I'm an investigative analyst working in our Paris field office, Paris, France.
And what does an investigative analyst do?
Kind of do a number of different things. So our primary focus is supporting Secret Service financial investigations. So we do financial analysis. And with that comes a number of other things, you know, creating link charts, so link analysis, mapping.
Okay. Yeah, no. And that's kind of why we wanted to have you on the show, because you had a couple of interesting things about you that got us interested in wanting to have you on the show and be able to interview you, because you're an IA that actually works in France originally started in Detroit, right?
Correct.
And so we want to talk about some of the things that you get involved in and what you do for the Secret Service. But before we start, I always find it interesting about what people do prior to the Secret Service and what they get themselves involved in, who they were before they joined the service, because oftentimes the people that come into the service are from various different areas of the United States. Where did you grow up?
Grew up in Muskegon, Michigan, which is on Lake Michigan, on the west side of Michigan. From there, I went to school at Michigan State University, got a degree in criminal justice, and kind of stuck around a year of law school, kind of realized that wasn't for me, and then switched over and got a master's degree in criminal justice before entering the workforce.
And so what do you do for fun?
A little bit of everything. So, you know, golf is the primary leisure activity, but now I've got two young kids and a third on the way, so there's not much time for that. But, you know, those are good trade-offs.
Did you play at Michigan State?
No, just recreation.
Just recreation. So what's the best course you played on?
In France, they just had the Ryder Cup that was played there last fall, so I've played that course a couple of times.
All right. What's your handicap?
Oh, it's, you know, it's double digits, but, you know.
Okay.
We're out there to have fun.
Okay. Fair enough. And then I got to ask, what's your best score?
I've shot 73 once.
Okay. So. Awesome. I don't think I make it below 125,
yeah,
150.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Pretty much I'm good enough to be invited to play whenever the office goes out.
Yeah,
but other than that,
good time.
Basically kind of lead us up if you can, like how you found out about the Secret Service and that situation where, because oftentimes what I always like to stress for the listeners is sometimes people just don't realize about joining the Secret Service and what they can do. And so how did you find out about it? What was your pathway to the organization?
So kind of bringing it back to when I was finishing college, at that point, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. You know, I kind of got a master's degree just to buy myself more time, try and figure it out. Most people, you think of the Secret Service, you think of the protective side. So that's kind of all I knew of them. So when I was finishing grad school, a couple of my classmates were applying for jobs as crime analysts. And when I started to look into that, it seemed like something that really kind of fit my interests and what I think my skill sets are. So I just started to apply all over the country and was fortunate to get hired on at the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office in Jacksonville, Florida, which is one of the leading agencies for crime analysis in the country. So it's a large crime analysis unit. So it's really good training ground. So in that, I was assigned, one of my units I was assigned to was economic crimes.
Okay.
And part of that, we worked with the Financial Crimes Task Force in Jacksonville with Jacksonville Field Office for the Secret Service. That's kind of how I initially got in with them. When the opening came in Detroit, they knew I was from there and suggested that it may be something I would be interested in putting in for. And that's kind of how I got into that track.
Okay. And where did your friends end up? Like your friends, because your friends went into the same.
Yeah, so they, well, a few in the DC area. One is leading the unit out in Seattle now, and I'm not sure what the other one's doing now.
Well,
Well, maybe we'll reach out to you once he hears the podcast.
Yeah.
With the economic crimes and with the police department in Jacksonville, right?
Yep.
How does that, like, what did that involve specifically? Because is it the same thing that the Secret Service does, or is it something that's a little bit different because of the jurisdictions and the location?
No, I mean, I think with a lot of our cases, there's overlap, multi-jurisdictional cases. So oftentimes it can start with the local police department and the case kind of gets too big where they need additional resources, and that's where Secret Service can kind of come in. So, you know, when I was in the Sheriff's Office in Jacksonville, we work collaborative cases with the Secret Service office there all the time. So, you know, I had a couple of larger cases that I worked in support with their agents there, and I think made enough of an impression that when the time came, they thought it'd be a good fit to join on with them.
So. Oh, fantastic. Okay. So that's awesome. So you get on the job, and what does that entail? So like an investigative analyst, is it something that I apply to? Is it something that they're looking for particular credentials as far as being invited in? And then I guess maybe walk us through from application process to where you finally ended up. Like, how does that process look?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, it's, you know, like a lot of federal law enforcement jobs, you have to go through the background. So there's the interview process, and then you get the conditional job offer, and you go through the background. And this process can vary depending on how, you know, how busy the background units are at these places. But I think it was about 6 months, and then it was time to make the move from Florida back to Detroit, Michigan.
Okay. And you had an option to do that when the spot opened up?
Or yeah, so I mean, I put in for the position, you know, went through the process and interviewed and was offered the position.
So were there any agents that you worked with at the time? Have you met them again back in the service? Like you ran into them again and said, hey, we work together down in Jacksonville?
Of course. Okay. Yeah, so I had lunch with one in Paris a few weeks ago.
Okay. And so what specifically drew you back to Detroit?
So family's still there. A good starting point, good starting office there in Jacksonville, but I thought it was a good time to make the move back north.
And then you eventually end up in France. So like in that situation, how does one get that? Because it's definitely you wanted to go back to Detroit, but now you're in France, and that's two different, obviously,
two different
cultures, areas, locations.
So I spent about 7 years in the Detroit field office, and we've always had one investigative analyst in our overseas position. So when that opened up, it was something that my wife and I sat down and kind of talked about. It'd be a pretty unique experience for us and for our kids. So it just seemed like one of those things that was too good to not pursue. So we put in and we're very fortunate to be selected for that opportunity.
So I'd like to go back. Currently you're in France, but I'd like to go back to the Detroit field office. And as far as what you do as an IA, like just starting out, what are some of your roles and responsibilities of what you do there?
Yeah. So one of the things I really like about working with the investigative support division is you get a lot of freedom to kind of make the position what you want it to be. So, I mean, you have the freedom to go out there and get involved in, you know, if you have cyber skills, you can get involved in cyber cases, counterfeit, fraud. So I was really fortunate when I started, there was a lot of agents that were starting at the same time that were really eager to get out there and work some really cool cases.
Do they come and request you, or is it an automatic procedure? How does that kind of relationship start?
Primarily they'll come to you when they need support, but I mean, you'll make the rounds and check in with people, say, hey, what do you got going on? Is there anything I can assist with? And that's one of these things in this job where, you know, relationships are everything. So I was always, you know, checking in, see what people had going on and trying to see if there's, you know, any way that I can kind of help make sense of their cases. Because a lot of these cases, you're looking at these complex financial investigations where you'll go into somebody's office and they'll have six boxes of bank records. And kind of what I've always said, the job of the IA is to take all of that noise and mess and create it into one cohesive thing where you've just got this chart that you'd be presenting to the prosecutor or a grand jury or a jury at trial down the road that kind of paints a clear picture of these really complex cases. So you just want to try and make their job as easy as possible and just go from there.
If you could describe like the Detroit field office, the environment, like what do you think is unique among the other field offices that are out there?
A lot of good relationships with the locals. So there's always something going on. So we have a financial crimes task force there. We're part of the Internet Crimes Against Children task force. There's all these different groups that there's always something going on.
And you're able to provide your expertise and your job skills to those different task force within the area?
Yep. So they, you know, in some roles, it's going to be more on the technical side, or the Internet Crimes Against Children task force. You may be going out on search warrants where it's more of an administrative helping log evidence and things like that, but you just kind of pitch in wherever you can.
Ryan, the reason that we brought you on the show is because I found out about the case of Jessica Haringa, which led ultimately to the arrest of Jeffrey Willis. And so I kind of wanted to use that as a backdrop to be able to explain your role as an investigative analyst in the Secret Service. And so I was hoping maybe you can start by kind of giving the initial start of the case and how you came to be responsible for doing the investigations during the case.
Of course. Yes. I mean, a lot of people, when they think of the Secret Service, they think of protection. So, you know, the president's coming to town, so we're going to support those operations. So I'm sure you can imagine with when the president or vice president comes to town, it's kind of all hands on deck. And my approach is, as an IA, is to pitch in wherever you can. So, I mean, some of those things may be more administrative side, you know, logging names for security access, and then more localized scale. One of the things that I would do in Detroit was doing kind of social media monitoring on a local level. So we've got a protective division that kind of does the oversight of kind of everything, but, you know, nobody has that local knowledge like the analyst that's sitting in that office. So we would always try to supplement that. They're throwing, you know, the bubble over Detroit, whereas like they may not know the street names or the buildings and those things around there that somebody with local knowledge would have there. So I would try to supplement that the best I can. And we've developed a really good relationship with our protective intelligence division, where ISD and PID work really well together and kind of share information and support each other the best we can. As part of that, that's not something we kind of do on our own. So we do a lot of that with our local and state partners. So on the backside of that, one of the things we try to do as an agency is to kind of contribute back to their investigations and kind of repay them for all of the help that they give us. So this often goes into, you know, the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, homicide cases, you know, with our investigative analysts or other, you know, specialty units within the agency. So that's one of the things that I was actively trying to do in Detroit, was, you know, reaching out to locals, because, you know, some had analysts, some didn't, but, you know, just trying to reach out and offering support wherever we can. So in this particular case, it was a young mother who was working at a gas station who kind of just vanished, so never to be seen from. So the end of her shift, somebody came in to pump gas, and there's no clerk there. So from my standpoint, this was in Muskegon, which is my hometown on the other side of Michigan. So I'm starting to see stuff in the news. It's actually on my honeymoon at the time. So I'm just reading in the news. So I come back from that and I see, you know, hey, some of these things are areas that I can assist with. So, you know, it's, you know, phone records and different things like that. That's kind of dealing with big data sets, which is where we kind of thrive. So I had reached out to the local police department there.
And who was the local police department?
It's North Shores Police Department. Just said, hey, here's who I am. Here's what I do. If there's anything we can do to help out, we'd love to contribute.
And see, that's, I find that interesting, that the fact that your investigative analysis spidey senses were going off when you were like seeing this happen, you're kind of connecting these dots, and you finally were able to just reach out to the sheriff's department, right?
Yep.
And that situation, because what I'm trying to get at basically is that you had that freedom to be able to reach out.
Yeah.
And for me, I feel, and maybe some of the listeners feel the same way, that it has to be official. Maybe I'm watching too much television, but that you never know that like these things can just happen through a phone call where you are just sitting there and as you're describing it, and you're just kind of like, hey, maybe I should reach out.
Yeah.
So no, I think that's very, and that, I mean, does that happen often really in the law enforcement world where you see these things on your off time and you're just kind of like, oh wait, maybe I should follow up on it, and you just give them a call?
I've done it several times because I'm, you know, crazy, but it's, I really enjoy doing it. I mean, it's one of those things where a lot of people in law enforcement, they're worried that, you know, oh, I can do this. I can do it on my own. And people can say no. And I've sent stuff out, you know, sent emails, and I haven't heard back, and it's fine. I mean, it's one of those things, like I said, we've had the freedom to do it. So, you know, before I reached out to my supervisors here in ISD and said, hey, I'd like to reach out. Are you okay with it? And they said, you know, absolutely. Anything we can do to pitch in. And I've always really enjoyed doing it. And I've worked on several additional cases kind of through this process. And I found that oftentimes, especially when cases like this that are just huge, they, you know, want the help from anybody who's willing to provide it.
You get this information and you realize that the person was abducted at the gas station. What's the next step? What happens after that?
Yeah, so I went over, met with the task force, and they kind of laid out what they initially had. So when it first started, these morning briefings where there was probably 50 people in there, and you're kind of going through all the tips, and I'm looking more from the analyst side. I want to know what data do we have at that point? So at that point, all they really had was they had a silver van and then a piece of a specific .22 caliber pistol. So me as an analyst, when they say we've got a list of both. So I'm thinking, you know, this is great. I'm going to link these two together and we're going to have this guy by lunch. And, you know, clearly that's not how these things work. And, you know, you link them together and you find out it's the most common van in the state and the most common pistol in the state. And even when you do that, you've got 300 matches, you know, statewide. So you start going through those, and at least, you know, it gives you a list to kind of work from. But you start going through all of those. And you know, that kind of carried us through. I don't know. I think initially I was there probably 2-3 weeks where you're doing just the daily stuff and you're following leads and then just trying to figure out new things to do. So that's from an analyst side. I'm always just trying to develop new leads, new things to look at, and just do any of that stuff that is kind of outside the normal investigative track, where from the data side, what can we leverage to make their job easier?
And that's kind of where I wanted to lead this discussion too, because you had these two very generic items that were commonplace in a sense, where you had the link, and that's kind of where you start at. So you have this like generic vehicle, and I'm guessing you just run the numbers and that identify the vehicle. But you also have to have like a special relationship with industry partners because they have that information so you can reach out to them. And I think one of the things that I enjoyed about reading up on your case for the interview was that aspect was, you know, you had identifiable information that the vehicle provided.
Right.
And then you already have, like you spoke about, the established relationships or creating those relationships so that you can reach out to the partners and say, hey, we got this vehicle in this situation. You know, what can you do to help us? Are you able to talk a little bit about that kind of dynamic?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and this may vary state to state, but in Michigan, when you register the car, you're not registering the color of the vehicle. So when we're pulling up records, all we're seeing is, I think it was like 120,000 vans. So you don't have the color. So we know from a witness the color of the van. So we want to try and figure out, you know, what can we do to narrow this down? And you can kind of run these things manually through different things and you might be able to do it. But the easiest thing for us was, and this is kind of where I talked about the relationships, was reaching out to somebody that manufactured the van and said, you know, what information can you provide? So I was able to get in touch with somebody who worked in the minivan division of this company, and they were able to go back through their stuff and say, okay, here's based on this VIN, the vehicle identification number, here's the color of that vehicle when it came off our assembly line. So then at least now you're kind of whittling that down from where you're going from 100,000 vans down to 32,000 vans. So just any of those things. And then that relationship really kind of took hold kind of later on as the case progressed when we circled back to them, as I'm sure we'll get into.
Sure. And that was the same thing with the weapon too. You just kind of work the identifiable information that was provided on the weapon, and basically you were starting to narrow down the search.
Of course.
So that basically the information was getting to a point where you were almost distilling it to the fewest numbers so that you had a more information to be able to go out and do more search, because you don't, obviously, with all those numbers, you don't want to go out and searching all those numbers. So you're basically trying to make your work easier in this aspect. In that situation and that investigative situation where you're taking all this identifiable information and you're making the matches, at what point were you able to find the two to link the two?
So in the end, it ended up being a stolen gun. So just kind of the one-to-one link on that process never kind of worked itself out. I mean, the gun was on that list, but it wasn't linked to the actual van owner. So from that point, it just kind of progressed. And over the next year, you know, the task force started to whittle down because people have to go back to their agencies. So we ended up with a core of, you know, 5 or 6 of us that ended up kind of working it throughout the life of the case.
And that abduction wasn't the only thing, too, that occurred during this case.
Correct. So a little over a year later, there was a young mother that was out jogging, and she was found shot on the side of a road. And at the time, you know, it was same city, but different area. Kind of, you know, the fact patterns didn't necessarily fit together. But, you know, it was one of those things where I think all of us in the back of our mind were like, you know, kind of wondering, like, could this be? And so because of my relationship from the first case, some of those investigators had reached out to see, you know, if there's anything that I could assist with that. So I started trying to support in that case, kind of working it independently, but wondering, is it linked? So you try to do different things to see if there's a link. So we had cell towers from each location. So you'll try and mirror those up to see if there's any matching identifiers, looking through dash cam videos to see if there's any silver van that pop up, you know, when people are coming to the scene, any of those things that from an analyst perspective, you can just try and link those things together. So a lot of just manual pouring through videos and all of that. So it's always kind of in our mind as we're progressing through, but it wasn't until the third incident where it kind of finally really came together, where it's like, oh, wow, these are really all linked together.
And do you find that I guess my question is, unfortunately, and maybe the irony is that more instances kind of have to occur before you can start trying, like being able to find the pattern that starts occurring.
I mean, in our world, we would love to have it, you know, after the first one so that, you know, the other ones don't happen. And, you know, you kind of carry that around a little, but you kind of look back and you realize that it really is. It's a series of events to really tie it all together in the end, that it's like, I don't know if you solve the other one without the others. So it's, you know, it's, I don't know, it's hard to say.
Okay. And in this situation, without going too far into it, like, what was the ultimate, like, figuratively, the smoking gun that allowed you to find out who the individual was?
Yeah. So it's one of those things that every big case, you know, you need that one big break. So it was, I guess, probably about 2 years after that incident, he was attempting to kind of strike again, I guess, for lack of a better expression, and talked a young girl into getting into his van and took off. And she kind of had that inkling that something's not right here, and was thankfully she was able to escape from the moving vehicle and made a break for it. And that's kind of where the van came back into play. And this is kind of where our big break came, was the one thing we needed was, when we were investigators, was just canvassing the area for days, looking for any lead, anything they can kind of go on. And he just happened to find a local farm there that had put up surveillance cameras a couple days prior. Just so happened this guy turned around in the Circle Drive, and that was kind of our big break, where it's like, okay, now you've got this van, you've got a much better picture than you had from the first one. So the first incident, you had really grainy footage, and this one was, you know, clear picture, didn't have the plate, but, you know, that was kind of where we had this break, where we could then go back to our partners in the private industry with the auto worker and see what they could do to support us there. I mean, one of the things that kind of helped move, you know, bring these cases all together is, like I said, it was a small community. The all these law enforcement officers, they were actually, you know, from different, you know, one's from police department, one's from the sheriff's office, one's from state police. I mean, all these people that work for different agencies were all working together on this first case. And then, you know, because they were all then all working on the second one, they were communicating all the time, where it just kind of helped bring all that together and kind of push things forward.
Forgive my ignorance and the kind of hokiness to this, but were you doing the pins on the map and drawing the strings and kind of figuring out if, like, where these patterns were happening geographically, that you would, this would be the best area to catch this guy?
No, I mean, I think in this, I mean, thankfully, I think we ultimately, I think they stopped a, you know, budding serial killer that stopped after, you know, we're able to catch him before it kind of became necessity to put pins on a map. So where you would have, you know, a serial rapist or something like that that's hitting more frequently, you may do that and try and pinpoint where they may hit next. But there was no, the one incident was, you know, probably 15 miles from the second incident. So even though it was like some of the similarities, just kind of gut instinct of investigators, where, you know, the detective would look at and just the way the scene looked, it looked like a botched abduction, where, you know, they say, okay, maybe this is the same. So it was just kind of just gut instinct that kind of led him in that direction. And then it really, you know, really became clear once we had the van.
The success from this, is it something that you keep building on over and over as an investigative analyst?
Yes. I mean, it's one of those things that hopefully everybody kind of does, no matter what your career is. You're always trying to improve. And it's interesting when you kind of go back and look at, you know, the start of your career, when you think like, oh man, I was pretty great. And then you go back 5 years, 10 years later, and you go, oh, wow, that kind of stunk. So, you know, you don't realize in the moment, and it's, you know, you're always kind of building on that and these experiences. That's why I try to get out and meet as many people as you can. You liaise with as many people as you can, because you're going to learn from everybody who has unique experiences. And that's kind of how you build and become a better analyst. I mean, anybody that is in this and thinks like, you know, they can't improve, don't need any additional training, don't need any of that, I think they're doing it wrong.
As I'm learning and going through the Secret Service and understanding more of the roles and responsibilities of what we do as a service, I'm learning more and more is that we're more of a support role, and that we kind of work behind the scenes to help assist our law enforcement partners. Can you describe in this case what that entailed?
Yeah, no, of course. So the for me, you know, after that kind of, you know, initial 9 months, and then, you know, the second incident happens, and then, you know, it's, I guess you, I never wanted, I'm always hesitant to use the expression, you know, that it went cold, but I mean, because we were always working it, so it was, you know, very active for us. But it's like, you know, the leads just kind of just start drying up, and all these things where you think like, oh, you know, this is it, and then it isn't. So you have all these just stomach punch moments where you think you've got your guy and you kind of run it down, then you learn that it's not your guy. So I mean, I've done, you know, a number of different things on this that, looking back now, it just seems like such a total dead end to even go down. But I mean, you know, talking photo lineups of everybody that, so our description, all we had was a white male driving a silver van. So taking those 35,000 that I mentioned before and mm-hmm. pulling up every white male that in between these ages and throwing them in a 2,000 person photo lineup, and, you know, actually thinking, oh yeah, somebody could look through this and maybe pick somebody out, and things like that are just so labor intensive. But because that victim was still missing, it never felt like, it's very hard to turn those cases off, where a homicide case, it's, you know, obviously very tragic and you want to find answers, you want to get justice. But when the person is still missing, it's very hard to turn it off, because you don't know what happened to them. So you want to always try and, you know, at that point, get her back to her family.
And how many times have you sprung up in the middle of the night with an idea that you're just like, I need to get back into the office and try to test this theory or this thought out? Does that happen often?
Yeah, countless. I mean, you wake up and you pull up the phone and write down a note so you remember to, you know, oh, I'm going to check this out and see if I can do this and reach out to so great about our program. There's so many people that come from different backgrounds and different skill sets that it's like, oh, I'm going to call and harass this person today and see if they can help me run down this lead and see if they've got any ideas. So, I mean, throughout this process, I've talked probably a dozen different IAs throughout the field that I really value their opinion and always looking for new ideas.
You mentioned the concept of the cold case. Can you give like an approximate amount of time, or do we just keep things open in the Secret Service?
We don't work a lot of cases like this. I mean, a lot of the financial cases kind of go on for a long time, where I don't think those are kind of, you work them until you work them and then they kind of close out. But a lot of these local support cases, they can go cold. So, I mean, I know of some other IAs that have supported cases going on decades now. And it's, I don't know what classifies them as cold cases. As long as you're still actively working it, I don't know.
You're basically just there to help them with their investigation until they decide what they want to do with it?
Yeah. So, I mean, kind of going back to the beginning where I said, you know, a lot of people, you know, the initial task force kind of fizzled out and people went back to their jobs. And that's something that I talked to the lead investigator at the time and just said, you know, we're here as long as you need us and as long as you'll have us. And thankfully, he kept me on board because it's one of those, you know, one of the relationships I value the most since I've been on this job. And I'm glad that I could continue to be a part of the case and contribute to bringing it to a resolution and getting justice for the victims and their families.
So Ryan, we have the situation where you had the second incident that took place, but you were continuing to do your investigations and they were leading into some dead ends that were taking place. And so over time, you continue to do the investigation, but it was, like I said, it was continually ending up in those dead end areas. What ultimately happened to bring this individual that was committing these crimes to an end?
Yeah, so it's in any big case, you kind of need that one big break. And that was where we finally got that with kind of the actions of the true hero in the case, which was a 16-year-old girl that he had talked into his van. You know, she'd been out walking, needing a ride. And, you know, shortly after she got in, she kind of, you know, felt, hey, this isn't right. And, you know, asked to get out. He, you know, sped up more and she made the courageous decision to unlock the car and jump out of the moving car going, you know, 30, 40 miles an hour. And then took off running while he's giving chase. And thankfully there was a neighbor that was outside when she ran up the driveway, or who knows, you know, we could still be working this and wouldn't have the answers that we do now. So that was, you know, her decision to make that jump kind of led to all of the things that led to the big break. So after that kind of incident happened, investigators are back out there. And one of the detectives spent days out there going, looking at every house, looking for anybody who may have any kind of surveillance video, and stumbled across a farm there that had just installed surveillance cameras a couple days prior, and reviewed the tape, and this silver van turns around in this driveway. And that was, you know, the big break that we were kind of all waiting for. It didn't have the plate. You know, that was the initial thing we kind of worked on, was to try and see, you know, hey, is there something we can do to get this plate? And that didn't work out, but it was enough to kind of get us back to that local partnership we talked about earlier with the Fiat Chrysler, where they were able to assist us with whittling it down more and ultimately leading to the suspect and the arrest.
How did you find him? Like, was he just at his home, just a normal everyday person that was just, you kind of knocked on the door and said, hey, these are the things that we have? Like, how do you can explain that process?
Yeah. So, you know, from the point that we get that surveillance image, they'd worked with some of the kind of the local dealers to now look at it and say, okay, now we know exactly what kind of year range. And then at that point, the investigators had asked if I could reach back out to our partners with Chrysler to say, you know, hey, looking at this, is there anything you can kind of do to narrow it any further? And one of the things they had zeroed in on was a Sirius satellite radio antenna, which I think the age of the car and things like that, there just weren't that many that had a satellite radio at the time. So that kind of helped whittle it down. So we went from, at that point, the list of about 35,000, I think, came down to about 350 statewide that would have, you know, when it came off the assembly line, would have had that radio antenna. Mm-hmm. So then I took that and pieced it back up with who were registered to those vans and mapped it statewide. And we focused on that immediate area at first. And we had about 20 people. And when you take out, I think we had three or four white males that kind of fit the description, and did a photo lineup. And one of them was ultimately the suspect that was arrested, was Jeffrey Willis. So at that point, now you've got your guy, you know, the victim is ID'd him. So now you're setting up surveillance and trying to figure out, you know, the best time to execute the arrest. And you want to make sure that everything's in order. Cause like I said, I mean, this is 4 years later, you want to make sure it's right. So we're all kind of thinking, hey, this could be the guy that's tied to it all. So, you know, ultimately ended up executing the rest with his van, and inside the van had a toolkit that had, you know, a number of submission type things, ropes, chains, and then it had the gun in the car that was ultimately linked back to the second victim, the mother that was jogging on the side of the road. And a lot of those things that were in that car was what kind of pieced it all together. So it was really important that, you know, we arrested him in that car and did all that. So the investigators did a great job of kind of then pulling all that evidence together, everything they got from the house, and truly tying all of the cases together, which was really a great collaborative effort.
And so your roles and responsibilities don't end there, though. So the individual's arrested, this Jeffrey Willis, but that doesn't end for you. You can ultimately be called in later for any court hearings to testify. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I ultimately, it's actually the first trial was shortly after I moved to Paris. So I flew back to Michigan and testified in the first trial, the murder trial, Rebecca Blesch. She was the second victim, and I was convicted at that trial. And then they did the trial for Miss Jessica Haringa, who was the gas station clerk, about 6 months later. So I flew back for that one as well and testified and was convicted as well on that, and is now serving, you know, life in prison without parole.
And so what do you in that situation bring, like when you're about to testify as an IA, what is your responsibilities in that situation?
A lot of nerves, you know, you want to do right by him. You want to, you know, I get really good advice going in, which was, you know what you know what you don't know. So, I mean, you just kind of want to go through all of the stuff that you did to kind of support the case. So you sit down with the prosecutor, because, you know, ultimately, when you look at the grand scheme of the case, you have a very small role, because once you then make an arrest, now you're bringing in forensics. So you have all of the forensic scientists, you have the computer folks that kind of started tying some of those things together. So you're just trying to take your part and make sure, you know, you kind of do it right. So you sit down with the prosecutor and see what he needs, what he's looking for, and you kind of carve out your piece and just explain it the best you can.
Is there anything that you like to do after you have a successful case, or are you just a hard worker and you move on to the next one?
Yeah, I mean, there's always another one coming. So it's, you know, there's always something active, you know, a lot of emotion and celebration with this one, that's for sure. So, I mean, it's one of those ones that you look back and you think, well, I can't believe that it was only 5 years. And then other times you look back and it, you know, felt like an eternity, and it felt like you were never going to get any answers. So,
Ryan, is there anything that you want to tell our listeners or the other IAs that are in the field about your time within the Secret Service?
I really enjoyed the freedom that we have in the field. And I think that's kind of a credit to our management to kind of, you know, be hands off and give you the creative freedom to let creative people be creative and get out there. And I've really tried to do as much as I could with that. So that's, in this case, you know, getting involved with local cases. But, you know, we've had several incidents just working straight Secret Service cases and doing that with agents. So it's just, my biggest takeaway is just get out there and get involved in as much as you can, and just learn from all these great people that you have, you know, our local partners, state partners, international partners, and then they're in your office, and just learning from each other. And this collaborative effort that, you know, throughout this case, and I probably didn't, you know, talk about it enough, but I mean, you know, we had several IAs that gave me insight. And then at the back end, when we had all this evidence that we're trying to, you know, help them out with and process, we had people volunteering anytime I asked and sacrificing their time to help move my case along. And it was, you know, very, you know, meaningful and significant, and it's good work.
Well, thank you for being on the show, Ryan.
Thank you.